Voices Radio Network.
Welcome back to Muscle Minds with Dr. Scott Stevenson. I'm Scott McNally. This program is brought to you by TrueNutrition.com. Our code is ADVICES, and it'll get you a discount on some high-quality supplements from a company that you can trust. Of course, go to fortitudetraining.net, check out Scott's training plan, and go to BYOBBcoach.com to check out the Be Your Own Bodybuilding Coach, recommended by the one and only Brandon Curry, our Mr. Olympia. That's going to have to be like the new tagline. You know, recommended by Mr. Olympia. How did you like that, Scott?
You mention the company where that code can work, or did you? I don't know if you actually said the company.
True Nutrition. Yeah.
I said
this company. Yeah, this show is brought to you by TrueNutrition.com, and you can use our code.
I just heard this company where you've got this great code that can work, and then I'm like, well, what's the company?
Top secret.
Yeah, exactly. I thought it was a phenomenal intro, like, because you say the same thing up for all the shows pretty much, right?
Yes.
It's the same intro, but you have to mix it up.
A little bit.
I'm like, you're doing a good job. I like it.
Well, thank you. Now, last episode, I had fun. I was like giggling to myself while I made that picture of Brandon Curry on stage, flexing and holding the Be Your Own Bodybuilding Coach book like that. I was chuckling to myself as I put that together.
Yeah, that's pretty cool.
I hope you got a chance to see that too.
Yeah. Oh, I did. I saw it. Yeah.
No, I hope he got a chance to see it as well.
Yeah. Oh, I don't know.
I'm sure he got a kick out of it.
Yeah. He's, I think he's still overseas until like pretty close to Christmas.
Oh, really? Okay.
Like, Romania. He guest posted that show.
Yeah.
And I think he said he's traveling. Yeah. I mean, I think he's doing it right. I mean, he knows, you know, that he's got an ambassador's role now that he can fill, and, you know, he can make money this way, but I think he just recognizes there's sort of a responsibility that comes along with it.
Yeah.
Not everyone has, you don't have to take him. It's not like someone says, okay, we're going to give you this Mr. Olympia title.
Right.
Only if you agree to the following things. He just kind of has decided that he would do that.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I'm looking up this, the question that was about alpha-lipoic acid to try to figure out why it was asked in the way that it was asked.
Okay, but that was Matt Marshall. I could send you a screen cap of it if you want, or I could just, I could read it to you word for word.
I remember, you already did. I think, I can't get it. I don't know why he thought there was, I know what he did.
What's that?
He mixed up bioavailability and bioactivity.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So I have the R stereoisomer being preferable due to its greater bioactivity versus bioavailability. So that's actually an interesting thing. So bioavailability
Let's ask a question too. So Matt had said, question for Muscle Minds. Scott recommends the R isomer of ALA due to better absorption. But could one get the same benefit by taking longer or larger doses of standard S isomer ALA? All right. I just want to make sure people knew what we're talking about there.
Yeah. So when you see bioavailability, you basically think percent absorption.
Okay.
That's because most of the time we're talking about oral bioavailability. Like if you inject something, bioavailability is considered to be 100% unless like some of it leaks back out of the injection hole or, gets trapped in the skin or something like that or whatever it might be. But oral bioavailability is what people typically are thinking of, and that's percent absorption. So some of it will make its way in the bloodstream, some of it will not. Like that's the simplest way to think about it. Okay. So that's where when he read the sentence in the Be Your Own Bodybuilding Coach book about the R stereoisomer being preferable due to its greater bioactivity, I think he read bioavailability, and then he just immediately did what most people would do is translated that into percent absorption. Mm. So as far as like the actions on glucose uptake and those sorts of things, the R stereoisomer does a better job. But as far as I know, the last time I looked into this, if you buy like just alpha lipoic acid, it's a mixture. Mm. And the R stereoisomer isn't necessarily pure R anyway. Mm. And of course there's the fact of like, if you actually go and try to analyze what's actually in the supplements, it's kind of a crapshoot in a lot of cases anyhow. So, you know, the thing with alpha lipoic acid, because people are like, you know, glucose disposal agents, you know, they're bullshit. Do they really matter? Like, what, like, you know, how effective are they really? Is a couple of things. Well, one, I know it actually has been used as a glucose disposal agent in the treatment of diabetes in Europe. So,
okay. Wow.
Used in medical settings for that purpose. But way back in the day, when kind of like in the beginnings, the origins of the internet, doing a cyclical ketogenic diet, people were doing like, you know, the 5 days keto, 2 day carb up, or 1 day carb up, or 1.5 day carb up, or at a carb spike, and all these sorts of things. And one of the things you would see these guys would do, especially then, the idea was to, like, you want to hold as much muscle mass as you possibly can, and of course get leaner, you know, combine those things. And the carb up was thought to be one way to maybe gain a little bit of muscle mass, or at least offset whatever you might have lost during the 5 days of dieting. So would really push those carb ups. And the standard way that would be done, like the body opus style cyclical ketogenic diet, would be you might do a push-pull legs or legs push-pull or something like that during the week. So Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, take Thursday off. Or maybe do like Monday, Tuesday, and Thursday, and then take Friday off, have Wednesday and Friday off, and then Saturday would be like a full body workout.
Okay.
And then you just carb up like a motherfucker.
Mm.
The carb ups were just epic that people would do. And they would always, they would push the limit, like go, like we're talking like sit down and eat, you know, 2 bags of bagels.
Ooh, God. 2 bags of bagels.
Yeah. Like two bags, like that kind of stuff. Like,
it's
just
like
ridiculous.
Hundreds of carbs.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean, like, well, that's why, you know, I think when we had Dave Pulcinella on the show, I was talking about how I employ nutrient timing, and just basically as much as anything as for a way to account, you know, for things. I just have kind of easy rules to follow with my diet.
Yeah.
It's easy to count macros when you don't have three of them to count, so you just drop the carbs on one day and kind of drop the fat on the other. And he's like, and I eat a lot of carbs in my post-workout meal normally. And he's like, yeah, all right. How much is a lot? And I said, well, like a box of cereal. He's like a box, like one of the little boxes. I'm like, no, like the big box, like a full-size box. He's like, okay. So that's when, you know, that's my perspective, is people doing that from way back when, is sitting down and having a whole box of Fruity Pebbles.
Yeah.
You know, cornflakes or what have you. So back to the alpha lipoic acid, people were trying to figure out like what would help with the glucose, try to maximize that like period of like carbohydrate supercompensation.
Yeah.
And one of the things that you can kind of tell whether you're carving up well is whether you've spilled. And guys would, and the idea of spilling, I've talked about this before on the show, my thought as to why people spill is basically, carbs are coming in into the bloodstream. They're making their way out of the bloodstream across the interstitial space into the muscle cell. And then they're going there and being stored as glycogen. So glucose goes from the intravascular space in the bloodstream to the space in between the bloodstream and the cell, the interstitial space, and then into the cell. And once that glycogen starts to fill and the glycogen stores are starting to maximize, if you've still got incoming carbs and they're still making their way towards the cell, but you're not disposing of them there in the form of glycogen being stored, then there's going to be some backlog. So in that interstitial space between the vasculature and the skeletal muscle cell, there you've got glucose. And that's an osmolyte. It's going to cause osmosis and pull water with it. So that's that interstitial space, which is going to be under the skin in part and elsewhere, but you're going to see it under the skin in terms of someone's physique, where the spilling occurs. So that's how I've sort of always understood that spilling happens. Same thing can happen with sodium. You take in a bunch of sodium, no place for the sodium to go. So it ends up, you know, basically filling the extracellular spaces where it typically goes anyway. And that could be in the vasculature, but there's only so much concentration your kidneys are going to allow to have there. So some of that sodium ends up in that interstitial space when you see that under the skin, and that's why you get all waterlogged, or you get cankles after you go to the Chinese buffet.
Yeah, makes total sense. Yeah.
Yeah. So guys were carving up and they'd be like, okay, so I took in whatever 4,000 grams of carbs, something like that. And when they were adding alpha lipoic acid, and I was seeing this too, that was pretty like a couple hundred milligrams just at that time, like literally we would order it like by the kilo, and because you couldn't get it very easily. You couldn't like go down to the store and pick up alpha lipoic acid. Remember, I had for the longest time, I had a gigantic Ziploc baggie full of alpha lipoic acid.
Okay.
You don't want to try to eat like if it's not in a capsule because it's acidic.
Oh, okay.
You don't want to like put that in your mouth without a bunch of water because it'll burn your throat. It's nasty.
Did you find that out yourself?
Yeah, I did. Of course, yeah.
Of course, yeah.
I'm just like, I had a whole capsule making the whole thing, but
yeah.
Even then you get a little bit on your fingers, and if you got your fingers wet, you could feel the acidity.
Oh my God. And to think you're still, no matter what, it's still hitting your stomach lining, and that's okay, huh?
Well, yeah, because the pH of your stomach is low. That's not a problem.
Okay.
You got hydrochloric acid. Your pH, your stomach is set up for that. So these guys were finding less water retention when they used alpha lipoic acid. And the thought being then that backlog of glucose causing the osmotic effect of pulling water to the interstitial space is lessened because you're getting better glucose disposal in some way, shape, or form. Either storage is glycogen or maybe even like by turning on AMPK, you're actually just oxidizing the glucose because you've got an effect on your metabolism in general.
Okay.
But guys were getting full and not spilling as much using the alpha lipoic acid. And literally, I mean, these were guys that were like, you know, they were doing this carb up like they've been doing like every week, the 5-2 same pattern. And they would just change one thing. You know, this time I did 100 milligrams each meal. This time I did 200 milligrams each year, 300 milligrams. I started burping up the city. That's too much. I didn't see an effect, but 200 milligrams per meal for the 5 or 6 meals held no water. Normally I'd be waterlogged. It'd take me like a day to lose the water.
And that's the only only difference they made. It made that big of a difference. Can you explain that to me one more time? Because I'm not sure if I caught it. What it was actually doing.
So the holding water, the spilling over, is probably because you've filled up your glycogen stores.
I follow you there.
And so the glucose there creates an osmotic effect, pulls the water in, and you spill.
Yeah.
So, but if that glucose that would normally be backlogged there, causing the spilling and the water retention, can instead be disposed of in the muscle cell.
Okay.
Because you're using an effective glucose disposal agent, in this case, alpha lipoic acid, then you don't have the backlog. You have glucose disposal as opposed to lack of glucose disposal and backlogging and osmosis and holding water, and you're there. So if you take in 400 grams of carbs, you're not going to spill. You take in 800 grams of carbs, you're getting close to spilling. For example, you take in 1500 grams of carbs, you're probably going to spill. It's because you've taken in more carbs than what you can dispose of. They have to go someplace.
Yeah.
You know, they'll be oxidized or, you know, stored as fat, or they'll go somewhere else. But along that pathway from out of the bloodstream into the muscle cell, they're going to backlog there. That's why I think this is my best guess as to what causes the water retention, the spilling.
It makes
insulin,
sense.
Yeah. Insulin increases vascular permeability too. So, you know, you can see like you get really vascular when you eat carbs with insulin. Like that's insulin. One of the things insulin does on blood flow. So if you spill with X number of carbs and then you add in alpha lipoic acid and you no longer spill, it's like, oh, it's a glucose disposal agent. It's helping me eat more carbs without spilling because I'm doing a better job of disposing of the carbs, storing them as glycogen.
So what's the ALA doing then to get rid of that extra glycogen? I guess that's the piece I'm not understanding.
Yeah, so that's the thing, and I'm trying to think of all the mechanisms that one of the things it does is it turns on AMPK.
Okay.
So that in of itself is just going to increase cellular metabolism. That's what a lot of glucose disposal agents do. That's one of the actions of metformin, a glucophage. One of the actions of what's his name? Dog's found something of the herbal. Form of the people use instead of glucophage or metformin.
Berberine,
yeah. I was like, kept on thinking beriberi. I'm like, no, that's the berberine. A lot of the glucose disposal agents have that action, and alpha lipoic acid is also a pretty good. It in and of itself is a free radical scavenger, the molecule, and it also upregulates free radical scavenging ability of the cell.
Huh.
So. the thing that may be happening there in addition, and there are probably some other, there are other mechanisms that I just can't recall right now because I didn't think about this until we talked about it a few minutes ago. But, and this is actually one thing that I mentioned on my Instagram, one of my Instagram posts this past week, is that muscle damage impairs glycogen storage.
Okay.
And that may be because it's just disrupting the cellular machinery in part for glycogen storage. You've just got a massive disruption of the cell in general. So the mechanisms whereby glycogen is, it's not just like put all the glycogen together. It's actually the carbohydrate that becomes the glycogen we can use is also connected to a protein called glycogenin. And there's a certain branching sequence that happens in human glycogen storage. It's different than what you would find in other forms of starch that you might eat. Hmm. So there's that. And the muscle damage also creates energetic demand, which probably may be using up some of the glycogen.
Okay. Interesting.
Some carbohydrates before it's glycogen because it just needs that energy to repair itself.
Interesting. So then you have more room to put more in, is what you're saying, quicker.
If the alpha lipoic acid, by acting as an antioxidant, reduces muscle damage, which antioxidants can do, that's one of the things. Like vitamin C will reduce muscle soreness. There's several studies that have actually shown like acute performance effects. You do a really heavy kind of damaging exercise bout. And you load up with like mega dose antioxidants. Okay. You'll have in some studies you'll see a performance enhancement 2 days later when normally there'd be a decrement because you hit yourself so hard with the previous exercise bout.
Interesting.
So it could be that the alpha lipoic acid by being an antioxidant is preventing some of that damage and then thus allowing better glycogen storage.
Huh. Okay.
That's a guess.
Yeah.
Yeah, but it does seem to do that. So it's an interesting thing because, we talk about Skip's a great example because I know he talked about it a good bit. When he would take glucophage, he got really flat. He said he didn't fill up very well, and I'm willing to bet because there's so much variability in so many things that there's something probably different among different individuals because some people feel like they fill up well with glucophage. Some people get flat. Some people can do cardio when they're dieting down and not lose muscle. And other people lose muscle like crazy if they do. And so if you've got a glucose disposal agent that's bringing in more glucose through various mechanisms, there's probably something going on with GLUT4 as well. That's going to happen anytime you've got AMPK being activated. Some people may do better in terms of just the way they're engineered genetically, taking that glucose and storing it as glycogen, and other people may not do so well. So alpha lipoic acid may be a really good glycogen storage, a glucose disposal agent that helps with glycogen storage for some people, just like metformin may be a really good glucose disposal agent that helps with glycogen storage in some people, but not people like Ken.
Yeah.
Because he got flat. And that's not a sign of having stored extra glycogen. That's a sign of having used up glycogen, having elevated metabolism, which is one of the things that glucophage does by turning on AMPK. It's kind of the energy sensor of the cell. So it's kind of like it's telling us like, there's a mild energy demand here, kind of like you're just walking, like a really nothing tremendous, but enough where the cell needs more energy and it'll take it up in the form of glucose.
Yeah.
And won't necessarily store it. So that's kind of the hit or miss, I think, with glucose disposal agents. Some they work well for some people. They don't work so well for others. But in the context of like a peak week, at least, if someone has water, and the way I deal with water on peak week, it's not really a problem. You get rid of it after the fact. But if you take alpha lipoic acid, let's say it's the morning of the show, and you know you can carb up, and when you add alpha lipoic acid, you're less likely to store, you're less likely to spill over.
Right.
Even I would wager if they've like, you know, what's the, you know, what are the two things? You want to be full and you want to be dry. I would rather be not so full and dry than full and watery.
Sure.
So even for someone where alpha lipoic acid doesn't really do diddly as far as glycogen storage, if it helps them stay dry when they're loading up and they're still getting somewhat of a load from the carbs that are coming in.
Yeah.
Then it's a nice insurance agent.
Yeah.
It's a nice thing to have to be able to take along with things.
Hmm. Yeah. I've never messed with it much. And I guess part of it is that I didn't think about it the way you're explaining it. I feel like after listening to you talk about this, I could experiment with ALA and get basically some direct evidence as to how well it works for me just by using it with try out first, doing a carb load without it and then doing a carb load with say 100 milligrams, experiment with it from there and see the response I get. Yeah. It makes a lot of sense.
It's super cheap.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, definitely give it a go. And a lot of the guys would feel like the next day, the ones where it seemed like it was working the best for them, they go in the next day and their Monday workout, which is always that awesome workout. You've gone through the whole week with no carbs and do like this. Some people would make it into like a real depletion workout. Like that was sort of, I think that was Duchesne's original idea, is that you really try to deplete glycogen substantially so you could get a greater super compensatory effect when you load it up. And so guys would do that. And by the time like that last workout, they've trained everything once. And then there's that second time where they really deplete it. So they're doing high volume sets at 15 and 20 and they're flat as shit, so there's no pump. Then they add the carbs in and then they fill up and they gain 10 pounds. And then they go in and train on Monday.
Yeah.
And the pump's just out of this world.
Oh yeah.
So if you decided to do something like that, where you added it in like on a regular, some part of a cycle in your diet, if you're doing some kind of carb cycling, where you can see one look at the dryness that you get, or how you feel like you filled up, how much you spilled if you do tend to spill. That was the thing with these guys, is they were spilling every single time, and then they're adding the alpha lipoic acid in, and they weren't spilling at all as much.
Wow.
And then you look at the pump the next time you go into train. It's like, do I have a better pump? Do I like a painful, like some people, I never had this thing, but it's like, oh, the pump was so painful I couldn't train. I'm like, fuck that. That's exactly what I want, man.
Yeah.
Give me that. It's like the orgasm felt so good I had to stop. I was like, no. What are you fucking talking about? You keep going, baby.
Yeah, yeah.
So anyway, yeah, I'd love to hear what you come up with.
Yeah, that sounds interesting, man. It sounds like it'd be definitely worth messing around with. And we had a couple questions. First of all, Jeremy Jason, he wanted to throw this out there. He just said he's sticking to Fortitude training as it's written. And thanks for breaking down my question on the last episode. So he said it was greatly appreciated.
So he's not splitting up those extra days then.
That's what it sounds like. That's what it sounds like. He says he's sticking to it as it's written. Another thing, one other question that somebody had, that they just posted here. This is in regard to, I believe this is the last episode. It says going back to, or maybe it was from a couple ago now. He says, this is James Hastings, going back to a previous podcast, how much glycerol do you use pre-workout and how many grams does it amount to? I want to give it a try and wanted to use the right amount. So we talked about that maybe a couple episodes ago.
Yeah. I mean, it's about a 70 cc scoop.
So okay.
It's probably like 7 grams.
70 grams.
Maybe. I just kind of pour it in there, to be honest. It's so cheap. I have a whole gallon of it that,
wow.
I go through the gallon in like 3 months or something like that.
Okay.
Training 4 times a week.
What does a gallon run for on Amazon? You said it wasn't that expensive at all.
Like how much? 20 bucks or something.
20 bucks? That's like not bad at all.
Yeah. Vegetable glycerin, USP grade, kosher, I think it is.
Okay.
It's got a weird name. Yeah.
Right on.
That's the thing. If you look at people who are using the mono, the powdered form,
mm-hmm.
that, the what is it? What's the name of it? The monoglyceride that they, they put like 3 grams in it. And that's been shown to have some effect on hydration. I've seen that research.
Okay.
It was just published as like a poster presentation or something like that. But like, there's nothing that's like 2 or 3 grams. Like, what if you just threw in like 20 grams?
Yeah.
You can tell. Yeah. Did you ever try it? You were going to get
no, I haven't yet. I looked at it online and then I wasn't sure which one to buy, but if you just say it's just basically vegetable glycerin, And that's all you need to do. And I know I did look at it online at the various sources on Amazon. I just thought to myself, like, man, I don't want to buy the wrong thing. But I'll order that today then and see what I get out of it.
Hey guys, we're going to take just a really brief pause from this episode of Muscle Minds to shout out our sponsor, True Nutrition. Guys, TrueNutrition.com has been around for a long time. They've been around basically since I've been serious into bodybuilding. They are a company that you can trust. You know, owner Dante Trudell is a guy who freaking loves this sport. And he put this company together to help people. I'm holding in my hands a tub of Mountain Dog's PeriMD Intro Workout Supplement Cherry Limeade Flavor. So we're talking about guys like Dante Trudell. We're talking about guys like the Mountain Dog, John Meadows, who formulated this product. Flip it over. Now, amongst the citrulline, the leucine, and the essential amino acids, we also have 25 grams of highly branched cyclic dextrin. If you ever flip a tub over and it says something like Intracarb Matrix, and it has a trademark, a patented symbol on it, or it says like Intracarb Molecular Matrix, or it says like Intracarb Molecular Vasodilating Matrix, and it has a trademark on it, that means that they're probably trying to BS you, basically. They're not telling you what's in the product. There is no magic formula of carbohydrates. If you mix a gram of dextrose with a gram of maltodextrin, and then you mix 22 grams of highly branched cyclic dextrin with that, you get some sort of magic. No, the reality is they're pixie dusting it. You know, they're putting in a little bit of the good stuff, and they're putting in a whole lot of the cheap stuff. Because the reality is that something like highly branched cyclic dextrin is going to be quite expensive. So if you want to buy it, if you're going to spend the money, make sure you get what you're looking for. And so I'll go back to my opening statement that True Nutrition is a company that you can trust. Guys, and if you want to shop with them, please use our code ADVICES. It helps them to know that you support what we're doing here. Plus, it'll get you a discount. We got a ton of different proteins, a ton of different protein flavors, everything else you can think of for your intro, your pre, your post. Guys, thanks for listening to me ramble. Well, I've got your ear. One more thing, of course, Dr. Scott. Seriously, what we're about to get in on this next section of the podcast, I feel like I'm in a school for bodybuilding. So sit down and enjoy. It's something you might want to listen to a couple times. You could want to make notes. It's really fun stuff. I really do. I feel like if there was a school for bodybuilders, that Scott would be the teacher. So guys, if you want to hear more from Scott, check out his book, Be Your Own Bodybuilding Coach. It's available at BYOBB Coach. It's also available on the hardcover version. That's at Barnes & Noble and Amazon. If you want to save money, go to the website and you can get the ebook. But either way, you get the same great information. And this book is a one-stop guide that will take you all the way through your off season, all the way through your prep, up through your show day and beyond. I mean, legitimately, it's a fantastic book, and I haven't seen anything else like it. Also, go to fortitudetraining.net. You can check out Scott's Fortitude Training Plan. We talk a lot about intense training here, and Scott's plan is definitely an intense one. All right, guys, thanks for listening to me ramble once again. Let's get back to Dr. Scott.
Something you mentioned, you were talking a little bit, you said referencing the posts that you had made this past week on Instagram. You had a bunch of stuff over there. Is that something you'd be up for talking about today? I know you had a bunch of different thoughts that you had shared, and you, unlike you, Scott, you were like knocking out Instagram left and right. I saw all these tidbits of information. I was like, Scott's adapted to Instagram. All of a sudden he's got like all this shit coming out. And where do you want to start here? Because I see you made, if you guys wanted to check him out, at Fortitude_Training, Scott has his most recent 6 posts, I believe. You had a lot of information here. Where did you want to start with this, Scott?
I just said, you know, because I wasn't getting a lot of activity on my discussion board. And I wake up, I planned to answer, you know, whatever questions might be there, and I wasn't getting very many. So I'm like, you know what? I'm just going to put some stuff up.
Okay.
Let's see. Let's look at what I put up. And I kind of wanted to connect some ideas. Let me see what I can't even remember what some of these were, but these, because these are things I've thought about forever. So one of them, first one was on epoch.
Okay.
So, and it was kind of funny because people did address what I thought they might. And it's a study that I've by Schoenke, I think is how you say the last name. It's, and some of these studies are fairly old, but there's nothing wrong with them.
Okay.
People throw out studies that are older sometimes for, I really don't understand the reason. There's no methodological downfall or error that comes from these studies. You wreck, every study has limitations, but in this particular study, I think I may have mentioned this, most tremendous excess post-exercise oxygen consumption that I've ever seen. It was just ridiculous. It was on the order of like 800 calories, and it lasted for like at least in like next like 36 or 38 hours after an exercise bout that lasted all of a half an hour. But it's friggin' brutal. They took the subjects did four sets each of a power clean, a bench press, and a squat in about, I think it was the 8 to 12 rep range to failure with 2 minutes rest in between. So imagine you work your way up to if you spent the next, like, I don't know if you back squat, barbell back squat regularly, but what would you do for a set of 10 on your best barbell back squat? Like when you were really friggin' kicking ass.
Oh, for 10, maybe like at the most 315. I'm not really strong. That would be a heavy set for me. It'd be 315. Same.
Yeah. And like, that's like a failure set. Like,
yeah.
10 for three. And like, so imagine you do that, you rack it, and then you've got 2 minutes rest and you got to try to do it again.
Pooh.
Yeah. And then you got a 2 minutes rest. You're going to do another set to failure. They're adjust the weight. So you're failing at about 10. And then you go and go to bench press and you do a 10 rep max there, do four sets like that, and then do power cleans. And I can't even imagine the power cleans. I would have done hang cleans with them because power cleans, the rack at the end is such a technical thing, but it's a full body, you know, power oriented movement.
Yeah.
And they ran them through 12 sets like that to failure. And I kind of believe it. And they followed metabolic rate over the next couple of days. And when they just did those 12 sets like that, and here's the thing, this is just sort of a proof of concept. And all these studies were, many of them, there's various degrees of applicability.
Okay.
And really the science is just there to inform, not specifically give an exact recommendation for an individual as far as how they're supposed to train or what they're supposed to do in the gym. Mm. But it gives you information to recognize what's going on when you do things that are similar to what was done in those kinds of experiments. So that is the kind of training that most people would never want to go and do again. That would be like their worst nightmare, to have to like recognize that the next day they're going to the gym and they're going to do, you know, 12 sets to failure with that kind of a protocol.
Whew, yeah, that'd be rough.
That's just absolutely mind boggling. That's total vomit city right there.
Yeah.
But when they did have those people do that, the excess post-exercise oxygen consumption was 800 calories. That's like more than an hour of cardio, of hard cardio for most people.
Wow.
In terms of expenditure. So chances are their NEAT would have gone down because they've been so wrecked they weren't doing anything besides, you know, sitting still and icing and probably swallowing Tylenol.
Right.
But a tremendous, and actually I wonder, because they still have the elevation in metabolic rate. So there's a tremendous epoch that can come from hard training. And the interesting thing about that, if you look at like the rest of the literature, there's another study by the name is Paoli, and they did kind of a cluster set type of thing. People kind of compared with rest pause training, DC training. It's not really quite the same, but and they found like 500 or 600 calories epoch. After one of their workouts,
okay,
which is a lot. It's a lot. But most of the studies, even like you do like an hour of hard cardio, maybe 50 calories if you're like an extreme responder. Yeah, it's not very much. Like that post caloric, it's not very much.
50 calories for an hour of hard cardio versus you said 800 on this crazy workout.
Wow. Yes.
Wow.
800. And those are generally with, you know, trained people.
Yeah.
So one of the things that, you know, is probably going on here, and this is what some of these follow-up posts were about, is that there is a energy cost for muscle damage. And they didn't do any muscle soreness evaluations in those folks. But I imagine, you know, and there's probably a huge performance decrement too. So that's not a sustainable type of workout, but it shows that if you train your, like there's a gun to your head.
Yeah.
Really, really hard, you can create an epoch. There's tons of like circuit training studies where they'd you know, they'd run people through doing like, you know, bicep curls and knee extensions and hamstring curls and like a machine pull down and, you know, supported row, you know, those kinds of things. And they run them through for 30 or 40 minutes and the epoch is like 8 calories, okay. 12 calories,
okay.
Like nothing. Like even when you do high intensity interval training, you don't get very much. It's less than 100. I don't think I've ever seen over 100.
Okay.
So that's why this 800 is so tremendous. So there's something there. So one of the next posts, I just want to like kind of make people know about that was this something that we talked about already was muscle glycogen damage. And there was a study with endurance athletes where they had them do some endurance exercise to deplete glycogen pretty substantially, okay. Something that they were used to handle. And then they had the one group that did the damaging exercise do a bunch of calf raises that created substantial muscle damage. And it really did drop the glycogen down much lower because they brought it down so far with the endurance exercises they were accustomed to, which was nothing extraordinary for these people. They were highly trained. And then they followed the glycogen replenishment while they ate back up.
Okay.
And I'm trying to think how many calories look they put here. How many calories did they eat? It was, I have the grams of carbs they had over the period was, the meals were 112, 161, 171, 135, basically 200, 110, and 246. So there's like, it's like 1,000 grams of carbs or something like that. And they were getting like no, there was no, for the first 2 hours when they had that, those first basically 273 grams of carbs, there's no glycogen replenishment. Right after that. How can that be? There was so much, the damage was doing something to the glycogen replenishment. Either, like I said before, the enzymes and the metabolism of glycogen storage were just so fucked up that they couldn't get the job done, or because the exercise was so novel and unique and created so much injury and damage that the energy demands were just gobbling up all of that incoming carbohydrate to the muscle. It was the calf muscles, such that there's no energy left to store as glycogen. It's just using it all. So that explains why this epoch was so high when these people went bonkers like that. So it shows when you go really, really hard, particularly if you create some damage, you can create a huge energy demand. So I wanted people to kind of recognize that, like those, like you can literally like whack yourself pretty damn good, and create like really a tremendous stress that persists and digs into your recovery abilities for days thereafter. So I was leading people along in these posts, sort of a series of thoughts. So it's like, okay, so how much soreness is too much then? Like that seems, this isn't really sustainable to train that hard to do those 12 sets to failure or to get so sore you can't store glycogen, replenish glycogen. It's not even back to normal 24 or 48 hours later. And that's when I brought up some of the interesting studies that have been done looking at muscle damage. This is like the third post as I'm kind of reading backwards.
Okay.
And all these studies, and we've talked about this before on the show, these studies have looked at muscle protein synthesis at the beginning of a weight training regime. And so you hit someone with their first workout, you look to see how much myofibrillar protein synthesis is turned on. And you'd expect the people that are really responsive to the workout, who get a large increment in protein synthesis, well, they're going to do that every workout along the way, and they're going to be the ones who grow from each workout more so than those who had a piddly protein synthesis response. And those are going to be the growers, and everyone else isn't going to grow as much. Didn't work out at all.
Really?
Like one of the studies had a correlation of 0.01. It's like nothing. Huh. It couldn't almost be more random.
Wow.
That's kind of wild that it was so low. Like even by like random chance, you wouldn't expect for it to be like almost exactly zero.
Yeah.
Just totally scattered. So it's like, what the hell's going on here? So in order to try to figure that out, and this connects with these previous posts, one of the things we do know that happens is the first time you go and do something novel and new, especially if it's eccentric based exercise, which resistance training pretty much is de facto, you get damage. And then there's a repeated bout effect. Whereas when you go back and repeat that bout, there's a protective effect from the first time you did that, such your damage is not nearly as large.
Okay.
There's various that may explain that. So the first time you go in, you haven't trained for a while, you get sore as shit, you go back, you train that same muscle group, you don't get nearly as sore.
Makes sense.
But the soreness is hugely variable. And I've seen that like with people that I was helping to investigate during studies I did in grad school. Like some people get so sore, and others just like nothing. And there's also some variability in that repeated bout effect. I'm sore a lot really easily. John Meadows is the person who I always talk about who's not sore hardly ever unless he does something really extraordinary. He trains really hard, yeah. And I train hard too. So the study that I mentioned here, they said, well, what happens if we like wait until this repeated bout effect is out of the way and we measure protein synthesis like 2-3 weeks into the training program? Then you would expect what you would logically think is going to be the case, or does it? They ask the question. If you look at the people who turn on protein synthesis the best, are those the ones who grow the best? And as it turns out, the correlation was like 0.8 when they got in like 3 weeks in, which is highly predictive. And actually they measured the very last workout and the correlation was like 0.9. So something's going on at the beginning of a new training period when someone gets really, really sore, either they're a newbie or they're doing something they're not accustomed to for whatever reason, such that the protein synthesis that results from that workout is not predictive of how much you're going to grow. Because, and this connects back to these other, if you're following along, this connects back to these other studies, is that there's a tremendous energy demand that comes from recovery and repair from those bouts that make you really, really sore. So the muscle protein synthesis that's reflected in the measurements that you make after a first bout when you're really sore doesn't reflect protein synthesis that's going to building new contractile protein. Some of it's building contractile protein. It's myofibular protein synthesis, but it's just repairing the shit that has been broken down
that makes sense,
through the inflammatory response, right? And it's a highly variable phenomenon. So some people get really sore, and those may not be the people who are going to grow very much.
Yeah.
And some people don't get as sore, and those may be people who are going to grow a lot, or maybe they're not going to grow very much either. So it's totally random. So the idea then that comes from that is that obviously if you do too much, you can get a greater elevation or you do a lot of a soreness provoking exercise, but you can turn on myofibrillar protein synthesis to a large extent. But it doesn't mean that protein synthesis is going in the direction you want it to, i.e. towards muscle growth. It's maybe just going to repair. You may just be making yourself sore and creating damage from which you're recovering repeatedly without actually accumulating myofibrillar protein and making the cells bigger and growing from the training. So if you do too much, you may actually be surpassing the capacity of the protein synthetic machinery of the cell in a way that you barely are just keeping up with the damage that you're producing, but you're never getting ahead of the game and growing the cell. So the question is, so soreness, how much soreness do we want, right?
Yeah.
How much is too much?
Or how much damage, really, right?
Or how much damage, right, yeah. So then I posted another study to connect these dots. And in this particular study, I really love this study by Flan et al. So this one was, what day did I post this? I don't know. It's like about a week ago. It says no pain, no gains.
Yeah, November 9th.
So, yeah, so these guys, this study was really cool. So they said, well, what happens, like the question would be, so maybe, who knows, maybe there's something about going, digging in and going after it and, you know, training really hard. And maybe you just, you dive past that soreness, you get that protective effect. Maybe that kind of launches you in the right trajectory towards muscle growth. Maybe that's something you really want to do, you know, like you do turn on something of the molecular machinery that enables muscle growth in a way that we just don't know about yet. And you do want to like get a little bit of sore and like sort of say, look, this is a new novel stimulus, Mr. Muscle Cell. I want you to adapt, grow from this, pay attention here. Knock, knock, knock. It's time to get after it.
Yeah.
They ask the question like, let's see if that is actually true. What if we just ease people in during the first, and they demonstrated this previously in previous studies, is that you can get a protective effect by doing very, very small amounts of exercise that don't evoke this massive soreness. Like a lot of the soreness studies, like just to get a strong effect, it makes it easier to study things statistically. You want to make sure if you're going to do a soreness study, you should at least get soreness, like at least in your control group. Like, does vitamin C reduce muscle soreness? Well, you should have at least a good amount of soreness so you can see if the vitamin C made a difference.
Right.
If the soreness was itchy, so they do like, and I've done these, like you take someone's one rep max and have them do like 8 sets of 10, just lowering the one rep max.
Okay.
So like, imagine you get like 365 on the squat bar. And you had someone behind you and two people on the side, and they just lifted it up for you. You had to lower that for 8 sets of 10.
Yeah.
Or 10 sets. That's the kind of thing. You get sore as shit from that.
Yeah, you would.
But you can – yeah. And then you get a protective effect such that if you go and do that again, you don't get nearly as sore. But you can also go and ease your way in.
Okay.
And I mentioned this. I kind of draw this to people. Like, you know, you've probably seen like the trainers. I've seen this so many times. I'll never forget this one time at one of the gyms in Tucson I used to train at. This trainer, I guess he just was like wanting to show this guy and like the whole gym what a hardcore trainer he was. And he was running this guy through, and the guy was of Asian descent, and I don't think English was his native language. He didn't look like he was very comfortable in the gym. And this guy was running him through, and they weren't communicating very well. And he had him doing dumbbell presses, you know, the dumbbell rack. And he eventually, after about 20 minutes of whatever craziness they're doing, the guy was rolled over, curled up in a ball, and was like vomiting on himself.
Oh my God.
Because he pushed him so hard, and they had to call the paramedics.
Oh my
so
God.
There's like EMTs and 4 firefighters standing there, and this guy can't even get up. And all he was doing was training upper body.
Yeah.
Because he pushed him so hard, like an idiot. So that's like an extreme circumstance, but people will do that. You go in the gym, you don't got to do shit. You just have people do like a couple sets of body weight squats, and they'll get sore if they're not used to doing any training.
Sure.
So you can ease people in and still get that protective effect. So they kind of knew that. So they set up 2 training regimes. They had kind of a specialized leg press that they knew would produce muscle growth and strength gains. And the one group was the no pain group. And they started them off with very low volume of exercise for like 3 weeks. And so they gave them an extra 3 weeks of training. The other group, they blasted them right in, and they trained for like the next 9 weeks. So it was like 12 weeks, something like that, total training. Or it was a 12-week program for the first group and like 9 to the other. And the total work they did, everything was about the same. The first group just eased their way in. They didn't get sore, and they didn't have elevations of creatine kinase in the blood. The other group had creatine kinase was elevated for like the first 5 weeks of their training regime. So they got blasted, they got sore in the way you typically would if you just kind of jumped right in. And the no pain group had just the exact same, literally almost identical strength gains and identical muscle mass gains. So you don't need to get sore. You don't need to like just kill yourself with a soreness. You can still grow without exposing yourself to that. So there's all sorts of other perturbations on that experiment that I'd like to see people do. You know, I love to see I'd love to see if there's some way you could take people and basically auto-regulate around their soreness, and trying to tease out, and probably have to be several experiments, but tease out what level of soreness for at least some percentage of people is too much and impairs their gains. So have them do a crossover study. The first period of training, and you'd have a time effect because you're going to grow more at the beginning than you will later. There's law of diminishing returns that applies here. But like, what happens if you train and you just train hard and your soreness is, you know, you go in and your soreness is like 4 out of 10 the next day all the time.
Yeah.
You're pretty dang sore. That's high, you know, and look at the gains that happen there. And then the next period of training, you say, I'm going to adjust my training downward so that I'm never more than a 2, hardly any soreness. Do you grow more from that? Can you use soreness as a guide? Can you use muscle injury as a guide to some degree? Because it sure as hell seems like it definitely is not to your advantage to train so hard that you get so sore that you turn on, that you basically exceed the ability of the muscle to accrue protein, because it's just trying to catch up with the damage that you've incurred.
Right.
So you don't have to incur the damage to get the growth. And that's what this last study, the no pain, no gains thing, showed.
So it's finding out where you're at then, I guess, what you can tolerate stress wise and what kind of soreness you can still grow from.
Yeah. That's kind of been the thing that I've sort of been trying to figure out is I've noticed there are times and bits and pieces that I've been sore all the time. And like, it's a very good possibility that I would have grown better in the past if I weren't as sore as I've been, because I don't mind it. I don't care how sore I am.
Right, right.
Like most bodybuilders don't care either.
Yeah. So, do you have a rule of thumb for your own life on soreness? Like, you know, if you train legs, we'll say, and your quads are just brutalized, you wake up the next day, they're sore. In your own mind, do you say like, well, you know, if they're still sore by the next time I train, you know, how many days do you usually think is a good amount of soreness on average to play with?
Lately, because of just kind of the way like traveling and the things that I've been doing, I do the auto regulation on the day of training.
Okay.
So today I'm going to train legs. Let's say day one or whatever day I'm walking the gym, I'm going to train legs. And if I start to stretch and I'm like, holy shit. Okay. This is rough. So what I will do is I will pick, typically, depending on time, but I will pick from one of my fortitude training workouts for the leg. So I'll either do like a heavy loading set day if I'm feeling really fresh, like I'm strong and I can push the loading and be solid and my overall perceived recovery is good, then I would do that. If it's a day where I'm like, oh shit, like this is just, I'm not going to improve on anything, like there's going to be no logbook beating today whatsoever, then I would go and do a pump set, like probably just one.
Okay.
Something like that. So because it's just sort of for the practicality of saying, well, I'm going to train legs today, and then the next leg training session would be actually I'm training whole body every other day. But that way, when I do that, then I know when I come in the 2 days later and I'm going to train legs again. And right now what I'm doing, just give you kind of more context, is a leg oriented day with some upper body work and then an upper body oriented day with some leg work. Okay. So I legs, more so legs, a little bit upper body, and then more so upper body, a little bit of legs. So if I come in on one of those leg days and it's like, oh, no way, then I'll go just do like pump sets.
Okay.
Like one pump set, the quads maybe. And then when I come back to train, even if that's supposed to be like a big heavy leg day, usually doesn't work out that way because I'm good to go. But like, let's say it's the upper body day where legs are not as important.
Mm-hmm.
They're secondary. Typically that would be either a muscle round or a pump set. So I would make the decision and I would choose the exercise as well as to what I'm going to do based on my overall recovery and what I did previously. So if I come in and I'm super duper sore and I did like a Smith sissy hack, then I wouldn't do that exercise again, because you're going to feel the soreness most on an exercise that you did to incur that soreness. So that's an interesting thing. Like, they don't do this all the time in research, but if you have someone do leg presses, like eccentric leg presses, and that's what made them sore, if you go back and test them 2 days later, they're going to have the highest level of soreness ratings on a leg press compared to a knee extension or anything else. The soreness is going to be high because the activation pattern is the same. It's the same movement.
Yeah.
So if I come in, I'm really sore, and what brought on that soreness was a leg press or a Smith sissy hack or a knee extension, whatever it is, I will not do that exercise. I'll be very, very sure not to.
Okay.
In particular, because I don't want to repeat the same activation pattern that already damaged those motor units, probably more so than I want them to be.
Yeah.
They've already been totally whacked. So I pick something else that doesn't hurt nearly as much. So I might go do like a knee extension.
Hmm.
Like, okay, that feels good. No problem there. You know, if I went and tried, I know if I went and tried to do the Smith sissy hack, which is the one that blasted me 2 days before, I wouldn't really be feeling that. Don't want to do that. Those motor units have already got, they've got plenty of stimulation. They just need to recover.
Yeah.
So, yeah. So that's how I would sort of auto-regulate. The next day, I don't really, I mean, I would notice, and I'd keep that in the back of my head.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of times with that, and you probably do this too, I have to watch just because the low back can get involved. I like to do, you know, heavy rows, rack deads when I can, you know, squatting movements, those sorts of things. So that's when I will pay attention the next day on my low back, follow that along. So if I did, if I squatted one day or did a squatting movement, and I wake up the next day and my back's really stiff, I make a mental note of that, because just, and I'll know that the next day when I go in the gym too, but that's the one I really pay attention to the next day, and I feel the next day as much as anything. That has to be managed. That's probably the toughest one to manage, I think, for a lot of people, is to figure out how many like heavy hinge type movements you can do, heavy hinge type movements you can do. And get away with it, because you want to squat and you want to do some kind of deadlift if you can, if those work for you.
Right.
But if you're doing, if you're squatting and doing deads like every other, every workout, and you're training every other day, like I am right now, then eventually you're going to have a day when you don't do something like that.
That makes sense.
Because the low back fatigue, starts to accumulate.
Yeah. A couple of things that really stand out to me just listening to you talk about all this stuff is, one, I think of people that have had, I think of one person in particular who had weaker legs. Goal was to bring legs up, and she would just destroy legs to the point where they were sore to the touch. You know, like they were sore, like as sore as you could get.
Right.
And maybe her case was to just back off, like less at some level. Maybe that was what was, you know, because we always think like the bodybuilder thing is like, well, if it's not growing, then we got to do more or hit it harder. When in actuality, you know, you might be able to really hit those muscles so hard that you're holding them back. That's one thing. And the other thing is all the way back to that first study about the amount of calories that were being used just for repair through very difficult exercise. You know, I got to think that this is something you can, you know, you've seen, Scott, you know, working with a lot of people online coaching in helping them with their nutrition, especially a lot of people that want to get into better shape. One of the things that I can't control is how intense they are in the gym. But I can tell you that I feel like people that train really hard are the people that tend to get into better shape too.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Well, there's a mindset, and there's probably some generalizability to a person's ability to deal with discomfort.
Yeah.
Whether it's in the gym under a squat bar or, you know, doing any exercise and in day-to-day life.
Okay.
And there's just motivation. Like some people are like, they can handle pain in general.
Yeah.
But if they don't give a shit about bodybuilding, then they're not going to, you know, submit themselves to the pain and suffering of bodybuilding prep and bodybuilding training.
Sure. Well, I wasn't even thinking of that. I was thinking of just like the calories that they're burning, you know, it's going to require more food for the guy who's training hard, you know?
A lot of things. So then there's somebody who's just motivated. If you train harder, then you're going to create a greater EPOC, and that's going to help you get in better shape.
Yeah.
When you're dieting down, it's going to make for whatever caloric intake you have, you can eat more and still have the same caloric deficit.
Yeah.
Or you're going to create a greater caloric demand.
Right.
To that
right.
EPOC. And I really think, I wonder, like, there's just a couple, there's like, there's a dose response there of some sort. That's the interesting thing. So let's see if I can. So dose response, it may be like a sort of a shape type of thing, but like we have like this, there's this Paoli study and the Schunke study. I'm probably bastardizing the last name, but and there's like, it's like 600, 800 calories epoch.
Okay.
And that's like super, and that's with like balls to the wall weight training. And then we've got all this like weight training, like circuit training, like it's like piddly, like everything is less than 100. Like yeah. There's this big gap. Like what happens like in between here? Like how do you get there? Like, and these were with, you know, both those studies were with men, I think. So, you know, obviously if women come in and train really, really hard, and then what happens? So, you know, what's going on there? Like, can you go in the gym and like someone do like an average, like pretty hard workout and get, you know, not very much of an epoch? Maybe. Mm-hmm. Maybe the epoch only comes when it's something novel that just really destroys you, you know? And maybe there is a like a repeated bout effect that it would make perfect sense to me that the repeated bout effect also manifests in a reduced epoch. If you're not getting sore, you're not incurring the damage, your immune system isn't getting engaged in the way that it is when you've really created some muscle damage that way and creating all the energetic demand that goes into the repair and recovery after the damage, it would make sense. You could go in and do the same. Those guys in that Schunke study, the 12 sets to failure, if they went and they did decide to like do that, like let's say 3 times a week, and you waited and they did that for 3 or 4 weeks, you know, by the fourth week, they wouldn't be nearly as sore as what they had before. I mean, assume they were recovering from that. I think you could probably get away with that, you know, like 3 times a week. It's half an hour. 12 sets, 36 sets in total a week.
Yeah.
It would be brutal. You'd have to like really, you know, make sure you're rested and ate, but you could do that. I wonder what the epoch would be 3 weeks later.
I would have guess would it be less, right?
I would think so. Yeah. Especially, but I wonder to what extent it would correlate with muscle soreness and perceived recovery, you know, those sorts of things. You mentioned that, maybe it was a specific client, but the person who would just wanted to bring up her legs, I think, and she just brutalized herself.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. I bet her weights weren't going up.
I don't remember.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, it wasn't somebody I was working with. I don't remember what she was doing with it, but I just remember, though, that, yeah, she would hit legs so hard, so brutal, that it was like she had a hard time doing anything after training. And then her legs would literally be sore to the touch for days after. So
And women don't get as sore as men either, so that's a lot. You know, the thing, another way to look, another sort of lens to apply to this is that when, especially if you get that sore, in the studies where they just take someone who's untrained and they blast them, usually you get the soreness and the muscle damage and the performance decrement, the strength decrement is peaks on like about day 2, like 48 hours later, something like that, you know. Okay. Some of that's just convenience. That varies a good bit, actually. But so if you're getting that sore and you're trying to go back in and train when you're that sore, you've got a performance decrement from that you've incurred from the previous training session.
Sure.
So you're not going to be able to train in a way that is going to create a progressive overload. Because you go in and let's say you're able to do sets of 10 with 100 pounds on exercise X, and you just blast yourself and you're so sore when you go back in and you're still sore when you try to do exercise X again, you can only use 90 pounds.
Yeah.
Well, guess what? You know, you if we look at all the different things that are involved with overload. Now, of course, if you've got damaged muscle, you know, you actually are going to have to use more muscle mass because the damage to lift X amount, because that damaged muscle doesn't produce as much force.
Huh. Okay.
They've actually shown that. Yeah. So like if you have like cross section of muscle.
Yeah.
And you can look at the specific, they've done with this with MRI, I believe, and they've done it with animal studies for sure. But the damaged muscle has a lower specific tension. So all the contractile material is, the actin and myosin are lined up and it creates a pull along the length of the muscle cell, along the length of the muscle belly. But if that actin, if the muscle cell is just like a bulldozer has gone through and wrecked it, and literally you have misalignment of all that actin and myosin, Now it doesn't pull in a straight line, but some of it just doesn't pull at all because the myosin heads aren't attaching to the active site. So literally you're getting a misaligned and a very economically poor efficiency of muscle contraction. So the muscle itself is just fucked. It can't produce as much, it can't perform as well. So you have to use more muscle mass, but eventually if you're training to failure, you're still trained just as hard and you just can't produce the same amount of force.
Yeah.
Because the muscle's fucked. So yeah. if tension is, as we suspect, is important for producing the stimulus for muscle growth, you can't produce tension as well because you can't train as hard with the same loads when you're damaged. You can train as hard, you can push yourself as hard, but if your performance has gone down, you're using 90 pounds. And like a person like that, the hard thing about it is that she may be going for months or even years, literally continually training with a performance deficit. If she could think back like 2 years ago or something like that, like if she happened to go in one day when she's fresh and not damaged and she can use 100 pounds for 10 reps, and then she blasts herself and then she uses 90 pounds, and she's always sore. She always has that misaligned contractile machine, or she's always got damaged muscle. Mm-hmm. She's always training with a performance deficit.
Absolutely.
She's never really able to produce as much tension as healthy recovered muscle possibly could. So her stimulus for muscle growth is always impaired. It's always suboptimal.
When you put it that way, it makes so much more sense to not train to that level of intensity or that level of destruction. It's just when you're in the gym doing it, it doesn't make as much sense. You're like, I just want to hit this as hard as I can and grow. But when I'm just listening to you talk, it's like, oh, that's a stupid idea,
Yeah. The next study that I put, it was the last one in the series. Was an animal study, and I don't know if I mentioned this, but it was Ted Wong and Frank Booth. I used to always call him Frank the Tank. Okay. It was like about 5 foot, 103 pounds, something like that. He was really, really small guy. But he was like, Frank was like, everyone knows of like Brad Schoenfeld now is like the world's sort of foremost expert on muscle hypertrophy.
Yeah.
And among research scientists, he's recognized as such. And he's especially now, it's very, very cool that he's recognized by so many people sort of in the bro science world, in the bro world of bodybuilding, because Absolutely. He does so much. It's phenomenal. But Frank Booth was the man back in the day. He was like one of the people who really was expanding our knowledge of the molecular biological underpinnings of muscle growth. So he's got some pretty cool articles. And one of the things that he did with the graduate student was this calf training study with rats. And I recreated this apparatus when I was at Texas. It was basically the animal version of what I ended up doing for my dissertation when I got to Georgia.
Okay.
So training quads with an isokinetic device in Georgia, there at Texas, the device was with rats, and we basically stimulate the tibial nerve in the rats, which would get them to plantar flex their calves. So do a calf press. You just strap the foot on a little rotary calf raise machine, and when the animal, you'd anesthetize them so they're asleep, and then you stimulate the nerve and make them do calf raises while they're asleep. And
okay. Progressive overload.
So there's a picture there on the Instagram. If you swipe the pictures, you can see the picture of the setup. You're looking at it? Are you going to?
Yeah, I'm going to pull it up. I'll put it on the show.
Oh, cool. Yeah, it's a cool little thing. What I actually did, they were having to go in every time, if I'm recalling correctly, and like literally put in a needle electrode and isolate the tibial nerve and stimulate it that way. So they have to like insert an electrode each day into the leg of the rat. And what I actually did was we did surgeries. We put a nerve cuff around the nerve. So we had a permanently implanted nerve cuff, and I wired it up to like a little cement cap on their head with a jack to it, like a female receptacle jack. So when we anesthetized them, we could just plug in at their head and zap their legs. Worked really well.
No kidding.
Did you find the picture?
No, I'm not seeing. Oh, yeah, I got it. I got it here.
It's like the fourth one in there, maybe, I think.
Yeah.
So they trained and they did various. They got about like 20% over like I think 6 weeks with about 20% increase in muscle size or wet weight, the gastrocnemius, I believe.
Okay.
And the whole idea then, and they've done this with some other studies, is to come up with an animal model that is more representative of human weight training.
Hmm.
You do all these animal stuff, like the quail stuff, where they hang the big weight off the quails and they get like tremendous muscle growth. Like you can't. That's not, people don't do that. That's not the amount of muscle growth is way beyond what you get with regular resistance training. And even like the compensatory hypertrophy studies where they clip the soleus and the gastroc grows like crazy. Mm-hmm. Like no one's going to do that. You know, you're not going to like, you know, take out muscles to make another muscle bigger.
Right.
In any, you know, so this was a nice model that represented what humans do. And they trained them like every 3 days. So kind of like what you typically might do, you hit your chest like Monday, Thursday or something like that.
Yeah.
And they had various regimes. They just, because it's nice with animals, they're basically genetically identical if they're from the same litter.
Mm.
So you don't have to have like a ton of them all in one condition in the study. So they had just each rat underwent various conditions and they basically got the same muscle growth in all the various ways that they applied progressive overload over the course of time. Hmm. And you might even expect that, like that happens with newbies when they train, there's a ceiling effect. Like you grow so fast, like there's kind of, no matter what you do, you grow really, really well. So all the various models, they got about like 20% muscle growth. It matched humans. And other studies have since kind of shown that animals, when they're exposed to a similar type of stimulus, at least rats, I think in mice, will grow at about the same rate as humans. So you can use those animal models to replicate and do things in animals that you can't do in humans and investigate effects on muscle growth with resistance training you never get past human subjects committee. But there was one animal that didn't grow. And they had that animal do every other day training instead of every third day training. Okay. And the frequency was too high.
Because
what that did was that increased the training volume.
Yeah.
When it was up too high. So that was like, the study was done in like 1980, something like that. Let me see here. This is part of why I posted this. Let's see here. 1988.
Okay.
So there's this. Now we're starting to figure this out with all these volume studies and resistance exercise or resistance training with humans, is that there's maybe an optimal number of sets, optimal training volume, and you do too much and you don't grow as well.
Yeah.
And there's some researchers in South America that have done a couple studies, and they've done with women and men, looking at 5, 10, 15, and 20 sets per week,
mm-hmm.
doing a bro. So there's a limitation there, but 5 or 10 sets seems to be optimal as far as muscle growth. And almost all the muscles they tested, that's where you see the best. 15 and 20 is too much.
Hmm.
And in one study with men, it was interesting because they trained them for like 6 months.
Okay.
But they made a measure. They didn't just make a measurement at the beginning and the end. They made a measurement halfway through. So if you looked, I'm doing this kind of backwards. I'll try to do it for viewers so they can see. So they started to grow and they got good growth and they made a measurement. If you sort of like connect the dots, they're having growth at 12 weeks. And then in the higher volume groups, they were receding. They were, the muscles were getting smaller.
Huh.
Because the volume was too high.
Okay.
They literally were overtraining. I don't know what the training loads were like. I wish they would publish that stuff, but it's from the framework of muscle growth, they had their greatest increase in muscle size in those higher volume groups at 12 weeks, and then at 24 weeks they were going backsliding.
I'll be damned.
Of course, that's when you do a you'd have deloads in there,
yeah.
Right? In a real, well, they didn't do that in the study because that's a whole other question. The whole other way to examine, like, how much can we train with higher volume and put in more frequent deloads?
Yeah.
Is Foxy barking is that obnoxious? Can you hear it?
Not to me. I hear her, but I'm good with it. We're outside. Dogs bark.
Okay. I think they're digging in the hole over there.
I've got Victoria's dog over here. She's going to come and join us.
Oh,
This is
Schnauzer.
This is Maddie.
I know Maddie.
Hi, Maddie.
I grew up with Schnauzers. I love them. So that animal study basically showed they increased frequency, but that increased training volume.
Yeah.
And basically, it's another way you can do the same sessions and do three of them versus two of them a week, and you've increased your training volume. And if you train too much, it's too much, and you've got an overload as far as a progressive overload that you want. You've got too much of a stimulus in the sense that it's beyond optimal, and you end up not producing the adaptation, and that's what happened in these rats. Okay. In 1988. Like, that's a piece of evidence showing this whole idea, which I've talked about here, and it's in the very second slide, I think, of hormesis. So you add the stimulus, you get an adaptation. You increase the stimulus, you get some other more adaptation. At some point, given all the other parameters that are involved, there's an optimal stimulus for producing the adaptation you're seeking. So for someone, given how hard they train and all the other factors that go into them creating their training stimulus in the gym, there's going to be an optimal number of sets, the way they carry out their sets, how many reps in reserve they train with, what exercise they choose. And then if they start doing too many sets, their volume goes further. Then they have less of an adaptation. And then if they keep doing more, they'll actually have a negative adaptation. They'll have a backsliding effect. They'll literally will overtrain. That's hormetic stress. That's hormesis. That's what resistance training essentially is. You're incurring sort of a noxious, damaging stress to the muscle, and it's adapting by growing. And if you give it too much, it's too much for it to recover from, and then you won't grow. And you may even produce so much damage that you just over the time produce atrophy. So literally, like in that Barbalo study, the men, the second one where they measured at two time points, they produce hypertrophy the first half. At least they only had three time points, beginning, middle, and end. But in the first half, they produced hypertrophy in the higher volume groups. In the second half, they literally produced atrophy. They were atrophying. The muscle was literally losing size. That's the definition of atrophy, because they were training with so much volume, whereas the other groups were still kind of growing. It looked like it was reaching a plateau. So the point was there. There's a number of points about hormesis and finding the optimal level of volume, given other parameters that you train with. But the research has told us some of these things, you know, decades before. It's not like we're reinventing the wheel. Like, we're first figuring out, like, oh, this, like, and bodybuilders have known this for forever. It's like, dude, you're doing too much. You need to train with less.
Yeah.
Just like that woman who's training so hard, you know.
It's hard to do, man. It's hard to do. You know, you tell somebody, and I still struggle with it. I still struggle with it. Scott, I still struggle with that even when I see results to show me the opposite. Even when I do cut back and I see better results, I still struggle with it. It's funny the way that works.
Yeah, you know, and don't take this the wrong way, because we've talked about this on the show, but, and I'm the same way. We're all the same way, but like you having a history of drug use and drug abuse tells me that you are maybe more than the average person wired for stimulus reward.
Yeah.
More so.
Yeah.
So, and there is a certain, like, if I push really hard and I get that reward, you're like, you're trying to create that. It's a stimulus reward phenomenon.
Sure.
So you want to go through all that. I mean, I know this. I want to suffer as much as I possibly can, because the more I do, the more I'm going to get as a reward at the end.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's sort of an addictive type of phenomenon. It's not sort of, it is an addictive type of phenomenon, I think.
Absolutely. You know? Plus too, you know, we look at, you know, in bodybuilding, we try to control everything we can, and we want to take charge of it, and we want to work harder. You know, that's the thing. Like, we, you know, would bodybuilding be fun, Scott, if I could just tell you an equation and you could do that equation, and in a year you would look like Mr. Olympia Braden Curry? It wouldn't be fun. Like, you might enjoy looking great, but it's like, really, it's about the getting there, right? And about the hard work and about the earning it. So, yeah, man, we want to earn it. We want to work hard for it. So, yeah, it's interesting, man. I'm 43 years old now, and I feel like I'm finally gathering it. I'm finally figuring it out, but it's taken me a long time. You know what the other thing is too, Scott? It's taken me a long time to actually, you know how Dante said, like, if you can't do DC, if you're new to training,
right,
like, just don't even try. Like, it's not meant for you.
Yeah.
I feel like right. that it took me a long period of time to figure out how to build the intensity to get what I needed to out of less.
Mm-hmm. It's so funny that you meant, like, I was literally thinking DC as you were starting that to introduce that idea, because that one of the things that I like about that system that works for me is that literally, and I would tell people this because so often I see this, like, there's some people over on Jordan's board, for instance,
mm-hmm.
Who are doing DC training, and they're like, oh, I want to bring up a weak muscle group. And it's funny, like, I'm seeing like a rewind of all the things that I remember reading like 15, 20 years ago. And, yeah. and they're saying, oh, well, yeah, you just throw in an extra set, you know, and and a lot of people are saying that there now. And that's not what DC would say. That's not the general advice that would come forth.
Yeah.
The idea from DC training is that you need to figure out how to put in the appropriate amount of intensity and recognize this rest pause set is all I got.
Yeah.
This is my only chance until I come around, you know, 5 days later, when I'm doing upper body again, I'm doing the two-way split, for instance, to get my chest to grow. I have to be ultimately penalty. So like the pressure's on. And so that's the way to make DC training work, especially with the progressive overload and everything else. But also, I think it does in a way satisfy that reward need in a certain way, because if you live up to that, if you step up to that challenge on a regular basis and you really make it happen and you empty the tank and you leave nothing behind when that set's said and done, then you do kind of get that, I fucking killed it.
Yeah.
You get that. And you can, and literally you can, you don't have to do 40 sets to do that. You don't have to like train yourself into dust.
Yeah.
You know, DC training actually satisfies that if you can get yourself to do it.
And that's, if you can get that intensity up to hit that, you know, like I said, man, it took me a long time to be able to harness that much energy in that one set, you know, even using tools like mm-hmm. rest pause, years ago, I couldn't do it. It wasn't the way my brain was working. I couldn't recruit it. Couldn't recruit the fibers in that, you know, I'll tell you what, mm-hmm. I fatigue more now using less sets than ever. And I've thought about this training with people that haven't been training as long as me, people that aren't as developed as I am, who can handle doing like a leg press with way more reps than I can, you know, or way more weight than I can. And I just think it's like what I'm getting out of it is just so much more at this point. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't need what I did before. I don't need to do, you know, the amount of sets or whatever, the amount of weight in order to really make it work for me. But it's taken me a long time to get there, I guess, is the point, you know.
Oh, it'll take decades. Yeah. Like that was a common theme back on Intense Muscle with on the boards is that and actually Dorian Yates was the quintessential example of that, as his training volume went down over the time.
Yeah.
Because his loads went up and his ability to impose that stress on a set per set basis was better.
Yeah.
So he didn't have to do as much. And you get that way. I mean, there's some of it, like eventually you get so old that like your just recovery is impacted by the natural aging process. But
yeah,
there's also like you're getting so good at pushing yourself in a way that you never could have 10 years previous to that.
Yeah.
That incur so much of an inroad, so to speak, to use the Mensur term, which I really kind of like, such that, you know, you can't get away with doing anymore because you're so good at killing it for a minimal amount of sets, because you've been practicing that for decades,
right.
Hundreds of thousands of workouts. Yeah. Yeah. And it's funny because that was the other thing we ended up talking most. And I know you need to you've got a ton of stuff to do today. But the other thing I was wanting to talk about today, if we didn't go to the Instagram thing, was the idea of failure and training failure and the utility of training to failure. And maybe we can bring this up if people want, like on the next one, it can bring it up, but,
it's a topic I love.
Yeah. It's an interesting one because, people lose the nuances of what people like Mike Israetel are saying, and Brad Schoenfeld saying sometimes about the utility of training to failure, not to train to failure. So, like, for instance, if you look at the studies, there's a meta-analysis that's Brad's under review, meta-analysis showing really no difference in training gains when you train to failure if you don't train to failure, if you look at all the studies that are out there. So we would say, okay, well, you know, then maybe it doesn't matter. You're going to get, and if you look at it from a recruitment perspective, you're probably recruiting all the same motor units, maybe not to the exact same level of fatigue. Obviously, there's more fatigue if you go to failure than if you don't.
Yeah.
But, you know, does the science tell us that there's anything advantageous about training to failure? Well, it doesn't. But what the science does not do, what the science has not investigated that I know of directly at all, or at least to any substantial extent, is a scenario with someone like you or me who has been going after this for like 10 years. And if you want to create a progressive overload and you're trying to do that, obviously with your training, like how do you not take some of those, how do you not have to go to failure? How do you like continue to leave one or two reps in the tank and create the stimulus that's needed to produce an adaptation? So in order to kind of expand that idea, you start off and you're like, you got newbie gains. So you do three sets of 10 and you're leaving like two reps in the tank. And you're adapting so rapidly that you can train with two reps in the tank on all of your sets for months.
Okay.
And months and months. Because what you're doing then as a newbie, as a beginner, is such a tremendous stimulus compared to what you're doing previously, which was nothing remotely physically taxing in that way, that you're going to get adaptation. So you can leave two reps in the tank. And then maybe like after the year, like now you need to up the ante. There needs to be progressive overload in some way, shape, or form. So can you keep on leaving two reps in the tank? Or do you have to start like doing some sets where you leave one rep in the tank in order to create the stimulus that's to produce the adaptation so that you can keep progressing forward?
Yeah.
And then you take that into the 5 years or 10 years or 15 years of training or 20 or 30 or almost 40 years of training, which is what I'm getting to now. And it's like, can you produce anything akin to a progressive overload leaving two reps in the tank? There's nothing new and novel about the two reps in the tank sets after you've been doing, after you've done tens of thousands of workouts over the course of decades.
Yeah.
So there has to be something in terms of how hard you're training in order to produce a stimulus, which is a stimulus which evokes adaptation. Because two reps in the tank is a breeze.
Right.
You don't even like, that's like nothing, you know? So anyway, that's sort of my thought. One thing that just occurred to me, and I've listened to like so many like podcasts about failure and it keeps on coming up, is that just like really almost aside from all the stuff that I just said, the logical thought process that just sort of developed there is that there's no, I don't know of any studies where they've looked at highly advanced people. Like what happens if you took like, take some average training age of 15 years, someone who's like literally been training, and like, what if you told, okay, now I want you to leave two reps in the tank on all of your sets. Are those people going to grow?
I wouldn't think so.
You're not growing really at all after 15 years. Most people aren't growing really after 5 years. But if you want to have any chance in hell of making progress at all, you're going to have to be producing the greatest stimulus you possibly can that you can recover from.
Yeah.
And I think the money is in the effort in each set as opposed to trying to do more and more sets with lesser effort.
Yeah.
I think the quality wins out over quantity, but that's a whole other, that's maybe another podcast.
I think that sounds like a good topic, actually. I'd love to hear what you have to say and explore that more for sure.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. So I think we're out of time, my man. Is that right?
Yes, sir. Yeah, I got to go eat some food, and then we're going to set up and record It's Just Bodybuilding, and then I am going to get on the road and head back to Detroit. And that's it for me today. Yeah. How about you? How's your day looking?
I have trained already. My mom is messaging me. She wants to do something. I'm not sure what.
Oh, nice.
I'm down here seeing my mom. Yeah, you know what I did? when we set up this trip for Scotland that I'm my seminar that I'm doing in a couple of weeks, yes. CRA Performance, there's tickets available for day two.
Ooh.
I'm pretty sure, like they said, how's the first weekend of December sound? I'm like, that sounds good to me.
Yeah.
Well, actually, the second day is the first. It's the first weekend of December because Sunday is December 1st. But that's also Thanksgiving weekend.
Oh, yes, it is.
Which I didn't realize in August when we set it up.
Yeah.
So I'm doing Thanksgiving now, like with my mom, because I like a buffoon. And those guys don't know. They're not celebrating Thanksgiving
of course
like we
not.
Are. So none of them. So I'm the only idiot. I'm going to be like leaving the country on Thanksgiving. So.
Oh, man. Anyway. Well, I hope you guys have a nice Thanksgiving then, Florida Thanksgiving early in the middle of November, and I'll look forward to talking to you about training next time we get a chance to talk. You said that there were still tickets available for the second day on your Scotland seminar.
Yeah, let's see if TRA Performance. Oh, it's the full. You can find it on my Instagram or go to TRA Performance. You can find them. Yeah.
How's this sound, guys? If you're watching the YouTube Think Big, then look in the show notes and I will have links there, links to this. We'll have links to the Fortitude Training Guide, and we will have links to Be Your Own Bodybuilding Coach, both at Scott's site for the ebook. And of course you guys can go to Amazon or Barnes and Noble to order the hardcover for that. TrueNutrition.com. I wanted to make sure you heard I said it that time, Scott.
I know. I was going to say it. I was going to say it for sure.
I wanted to thank TrueNutrition.com for sponsoring everything that we do at Think Big Bodybuilding Media and at the Advices Radio Network. Guys, you can use our code ADVICES for an additional discount and let them know that you're supporting what we do. Lots of great products over there, Scott. I'm going to try the so they're no longer producing the MPA muscle intrusion product, but they do have their MD, I think it's called Perry MD. So I'm going to give Perry MD a try, which is the John Meadows version of their intro workout. I'll let you guys know what I think about that. And Dr. Scott, enjoy your travels. Enjoy your Thanksgiving.
You too, my man. See you guys.